Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we look at the science fiction field from all the angles, past, present, and future. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And we're recording in August 2023, and once again, we're going to be exploring Doctor Who, the British TV series which is 60 years old this year. We'll also have a quiz, and we'll also have our usual roundup of recommendations of past, present, and future science fiction. So, Colin, last time we looked at a really old Doctor Who. This time we looked at one which is also a bit old, because it's from, what, 2009?
It is, yes.
And it's called The Waters of Mars. Watching it for this podcast, is that the first time you'd seen that episode?
It is. I hadn't seen any of the newer Doctor Whos from, you know, the second regeneration, one might say.
Yeah, yeah. I still can't get over what kind of psychological shock there must be going from the William Hartnell episode in grainy black and white and then suddenly leaping into the 2000s with David Tennant.
Yeah, it was quite the change. One of the things that I really loved, that caught my attention, in fact, about the original Doctor Who that I watched in the 80s, was the title credits and the ending credits.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with the theremin and the swirly graphics. And that is something that has kind of stayed true to Doctor Who, at least the three points in time that I've watched.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, that's something that I should have mentioned in the previous episode when we were talking about the very first Doctor Who. And that's the music. The credit for the music is always given to Ron Grainer, who's a composer. He wrote theme tunes for lots of TV shows in the 60s, and he did indeed compose it. But the most striking thing about the music is the arrangement. And I think the original credit back in 1963 said music by Ron Grainer and the BBC Radiophonic Workshop.
Yes.
Now, the BBC Radiophonic Workshop was a collection of people who made electronic sounds and music for various BBC programmes. And it was Delia Derbyshire who actually created the music, presumably through a multi-track recording. But there's all sorts of weird sounds in there. You said theremin. I don't know if she even used a theremin. I think it may have been some other method of synthesis, but I don't know enough about it. And then the opening titles to the original Doctor Who uses video feedback, which is basically where you connect a video camera to a monitor, and then you point the camera at the monitor, so that any time the camera moves, you'll get this sort of repeated pattern and these sort of swirling effects. And if you've never done that with your cameras, Colin, when you're setting up at the church, you should try pointing the camera at the monitor and see if you can get the Doctor Who effect.
I think we have. It's just, it's hard to do that with that 70-foot distance, because yeah, the screens are behind the stage. So, of course, they do zoom. More experimentation is required.
But the interesting thing with watching An Unearthly Child from 1963, the thing I found interesting was that the visual effect you see in the title sequence, this video feedback, is used again within the episode when the TARDIS actually starts travelling. So it's clearly saying to us that this pattern is somehow indicative of the motion of the TARDIS. And then when we come through to modern Who, you again have these sort of swirly patterns filling the screen, but now you see the TARDIS actually travelling along with those patterns. So it is still the same basic concept, that the swirly movement somehow is related to the tumbling through time that the TARDIS does. I think that's really quite nice. The modern music tends to be done by a full orchestra.
That was one of the things that first got me into music. That and Herb Alpert. Well, I realized that for the music to be synchronized with a movie, that the conductor had to be watching the movie as he conducted.
Oh, yeah.
To get all the beats and the timing right. And I daydreamed about being in that orchestra in a big room with a big projection screen, playing the music that brought the heart and the motion to a movie. And that was part of the reason why I became a musician. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say you were influenced by the Doctor Who theme tune.
No, this would have been quite a ways before I watched Doctor Who. 4 or 5 years.
So this episode that we watched, The Waters of Mars, the reason I suggested this one is because it won a Hugo Award, and it seemed to me that it was more or less a standalone episode. So I thought it might be easier for both of us, really, to kind of make sense of the episode without knowing in detail what went immediately before and what immediately follows. So did it make sense for you as a standalone?
It did. I was a little shocked by a couple of things, and that was, as I began my own research about Doctor Who, and I remembered watching Doctor Who back in the day, on this DVD that I borrowed from my library for The Waters of Mars, I expected 4 half-hour segments comprising the series,
right,
The Water and Mars, and this appears to be a 1-hour episode.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, is that the difference between the old version of Doctor Who and the new version, or is this a special, or...
It varies. I mean, it certainly was the case that Doctor Who started out with serials, but as far as I recall, there have always been one-offs, you know, so individual standalone episodes as well. And in modern times, I think it's probably tended more towards one-offs than to serials, but it's a bit of a mix-up.
And are they all an hour long these days?
I'm going to say no. I think they're usually more like 46, 48 minutes. Quite why they did that, I don't know for sure. I'm guessing it makes the series more saleable around the world.
Yeah, yeah. There were a couple of items in this Doctor Who episode which are callbacks to the past in various ways.
Hmm.
One of which was incredible because the main character... not really a companion, but she is the foil for the Doctor in this episode. She met the Daleks in 2009.
Oh, yes.
So she's the commander of the mission that's landing on Mars to settle. And she recalls a time in 2009 where the Daleks were invading the Earth. And she saw one and it looked right at her and then let her be. And there are reasons for that. So there's that, which I thought was a cool callback to the other parts of, you know, the other Doctor Who stories that have been told in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear on the timeline, this episode was made in 2009. The meeting she had with the Dalek was in 2009 when she was a girl. But the main episode is set in, 2059 or something?
Yes.
So she's now an adult. She would be, I suppose she's in her late 50s or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, that was such a good callback that for a while I thought there that maybe that was actually flashing back to a previous episode. So I felt compelled to look it up immediately after watching the episode. I went and looked it up just to see if it was literally calling back to a previous episode. And apparently it isn't.
Oh.
But it made me think that they might have done an episode where they had shown her as a girl. So the setup here, as you say, we're on Mars. We've got the first colonists on Mars, and something goes awry. Just as the Doctor arrives, by sheer coincidence, he apparently randomly just arrives on Mars, finds himself in this first colony, and they are faced with some sort of alien presence, which is in the water. And basically, if you get touched by water in this episode, you're going to turn into a creature. And these creatures drool Martian water out of their mouths constantly and out of their hands. So that's the basic premise.
Yep. And the question is whether or not the colonists will survive this invasion or not.
And the Doctor, being a time traveler, he knows something they don't know. He knows their future, and he knows that they all die in 2059. And that really is where the main drama comes from the Doctor's point of view, is he going to do anything? Can he save them? Should he even bother trying to save them? Or must he recognise that he can't change things? As a Time Lord, he can interfere. We've seen it in many episodes that he can and does interfere with time. But what he realises in this story is that some events in time are kind of pivotal events. Some things can be changed, but some events cannot be changed. And so therefore, it doesn't matter what he does, nothing can change. So he kind of washes his hands of it and says, I can't do anything here. And he tries to leave. But it turns out he was right when he said, doesn't matter what he does, he can't change anything. Because at the end of the episode, having saved all these people, they die anyway. Or at least the central character, the woman that you referred to, she dies anyway. At her own hand. And that's quite a powerful moment, I thought. It reminded me in some ways of the Star Trek episode City on the Edge of Forever, you know, where Captain Kirk falls in love with Joan Collins. And whether or not he can prevent her death, whether he should prevent her death. It's a similar kind of dynamic here.
And the consequences of if he interferes or doesn't. McCoy goes back in time and saves her life.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and the Enterprise disappears, and so they go back in time to figure out what he broke, and then he does fall in love with her, and then is left with the conundrum.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
I love this woman. If I save her life, she'll be okay, and then I'll change the entire future of the galaxy. And if I don't save her life, well, then what does that mean about me as a human, as a person in love? And
yeah.
The Doctor isn't faced exactly with that choice.
No.
But here's this person that he comes to know and respect, and he cannot save the commander's life. Because if he does, her granddaughter will lose her motivation and not go pursue her and fly the first lightspeed ship.
And that reminded me of something else, but I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was about that inspiring the next generation. It feels like a very science fictional concept. I'm sure you can tell stories in a non-science fiction way that have that similar basis, but it feels like something we've seen before, and it's quite inspiring and quite dramatic.
Well, and then touching for he, because the Doctor explains to her why he can't do anything.
Yes.
But then something happens to the Doctor. And this is the cool thing about Doctor Who, is they can continually play on this idea that the Doctor, although he's an alien, he can grow and change in his character and personality as well.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes not in positive ways. So he decides, since he's the last Time Lord, he can change time, and the laws of time will obey him.
Yeah.
And he ends up rescuing the last three people that aren't turned into Martian water monsters.
Yeah.
And then she begins to question him. And there's this great role reversal where, you know, he was the Doctor and he's going to be their savior. But then she, you know, upends this and says, well, what about the future of humanity? And what about my legacy? And what about... And he's like, oh, they'll find other ways to do things. Don't worry about it. And then, yeah, she literally takes her life into her own hands and ends it so that her granddaughter will then succeed.
Yeah.
And time does change, but not significantly enough to stop that pattern from happening the way that it should.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I remember correctly, the way that we're shown that is by essentially seeing newspaper headlines. I mean, they're websites, but it's like we see a newspaper report about the death of the commander, and a detail will change, reflecting the fact that in one version of time, she dies on Mars. In another version, she dies on Earth. So we see the newspaper story change just by a couple of words, and yet we still see the same end result, that the daughter or the granddaughter or the following generations live up to her legacy.
Yeah.
I did wonder who is supposed to be looking at these web pages or these newspaper stories. Is this how the Doctor does his research? or does he know about stuff in the future through some other sixth sense? You know, I'm not quite sure. I can't imagine him Googling stuff.
Well, I figured he has a copy of the Encyclopedia Galactica.
Oh, I suppose so, yeah. Interestingly, first of all, he decides he can't do anything. Because there's nothing, there is literally nothing he can do to change this pivotal event. That's his rationale. And then he has a change of heart and he comes back to save them. And when he does that, he becomes really very arrogant and basically saying, I am the only Time Lord. Everything has to obey me now.
I think being more familiar with the Tom Baker Doctor, I was just shocked at this turn, and I wonder what it means for the character. So after I watched the episode on the DVD, there's a 75-minute long documentary about the making of this episode. And what they realized is that David Tennant's time as the Doctor is ending.
Yeah.
And because of that, they can start to tell stories that they can't normally do, because there'll be a new Doctor soon. You get a reset. And so you can wander from core tenets, because, yeah, things are going to go back to the way they used to be.
Yeah.
And there is a callback in this episode to some prophecies or foretellings about what's going to happen to the Doctor. You know, the four knocks and the presence of the Ood.
Yeah, yeah.
That always makes me want to know more about the larger story instead of just look at the episode in isolation like this.
Yes. I hope I've got this right, but I think from having watched this when it first went out, I think the four knocks correspond to the initial four beats of the Doctor Who theme tune. You know, it goes da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-dum. So there's four beats there. I think that's right. If not, I'm going to look very silly when all the Whovians write in and tell me that I'm totally wrong.
That happens to me so frequently, you'll get used to it.
I thought the structure of the story was really very strong. I really liked the fact that each time we see one of these Martian creatures, a human who's turned into this sort of drooling Martian, each time we see it, we see a little bit more and we learn a little bit more until eventually we have quite a clear picture. Obviously, there's some exposition in there and people saying, oh, yeah, that they're doing this because blah, blah, blah. But mostly what they're doing is they're showing us some things visually and they're reinforcing it each time. So the first time we see one of them, the character has his back to us and he turns around and we've got this kind of scare shot as we see his monstrous face, and then we cut very quickly to something else. So that the first moment is a scare moment. And then I think the second time we have essentially the same shot again, the same sort of turning of the head, but this time we're able to linger on it a bit more. And I think we see the water drooling a bit more. And then later on we see it happen to another character. Oh, and the first couple of times that a character turns into one of these Martians, they're in the background of the shot. And we're actually focused on somebody else who is talking. And it's, I think in the second time that it happens, it's almost as if the foreground character is saying stuff that is so boring that it's turned the other person into the Martian. But they're sort of in the background shaking. And then because the shot stays there for such a long time, you become conscious as a viewer that, oh my God, somebody else is changing. So I thought it was really nicely done and very much in the tradition of what Doctor Who became. In the very, very first Doctor Who, there was no monster. But very soon after, back in the 60s, Doctor Who became a Monster of the Week show. And you'd have the Daleks, or you'd have the Cybermen, or you'd have the Sontarans, different alien races that were there mostly to scare us. And this is a sort of a modern incarnation of that with these Martian creatures. But as with some of the best previous stuff, and as with the best Star Trek, we have some kind of sympathy for these aliens. They're not really presented as villains as such. I mean, they do want to take over the Earth because the Earth is mostly water and they really fancy the idea of moving there. But, you know, it's not as if they are evil. They're just trying to survive, as we would. Well, indeed, as all the other characters are trying to do in the episode.
Yeah, that's something I didn't pick up on, because they're taking over another person.
Yeah.
I did write a quick note here that I don't think that the British Carrot Growers Association was a fan of this particular episode, because that's the way you become infected is by taking in some of this Martian water that hasn't been filtered correctly. And the way the first person gets converted is he has grown one of the first carrots on Mars. And so he picks it up, he dusts it off, and he takes a bite. And then, the camera shot change talks that you talked about happens. And so we're now listening to someone kind of drone on and on. Whereas in the back, this person's being converted into a member of what's called the Flood.
Yes.
I was also pleasantly surprised to see how casually some things happen. So the question of where these people came from is never really answered, or why the water is, you know, causes infection. But the doctor says, almost a throwaway line, you know, oh, they must have been frozen here in the past to save the planet.
Ah, I didn't catch that. I sort of latched on to a bit. I think one of the other characters says that it's like a virus frozen in the ice.
Yeah. I was a little shell-shocked because we talked about the change in music between the original series and this new series.
Yeah.
But the special effects and the makeup and the prosthetics and the sets are all really nice.
Yeah.
One of the things that was fun for me back in the day of Doctor Who in the 80s was kind of the campiness of it. You know, and even the Daleks kind of look like a spruced up garbage can turned upside down. But this was nice and polished, and things looked well. And
yeah, it's light years ahead of what it used to be, isn't it? I mean, it really does have a bigger budget, and not just because of inflation. I mean, if you adjust for inflation, it genuinely has more money invested in it, and I think that is largely because they've seen that the international market offers huge potential. I think all the time that Doctor Who was made on videotape back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, it had a limited saleability around the world, because certainly in America it would look very cheap compared to American shows which were made on film. So once you get into the modern era and they're able to make episodes that look as if they're films, it opens up a whole new market. There was a time when I think BBC America, although it is the BBC, it's run as a kind of a separate business, I understand. I think BBC America were investing in the episode. So it wasn't just domestic BBC television investing for British viewers. It was some money coming in from outside.
It reminds me of the difference in special effects between the different Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
So initially it's shot on a budget, which they did go over, but as they became more and more successful, they would invest more and more back into the movie to make it better and better and better.
Yeah.
And that, accompanied with the great acting and scripting and editing, continued to make better and better movies.
Yes. I think on the whole, I really like the Waters on Mars. Is it Waters on or Waters of Mars? Can't remember. I really like it because it is traditional Doctor Who in that it's about a monster. It is traditional Doctor Who in that it involves time travel. Mm-hmm. And it is among the better Doctor Who's in being about the Doctor having to make a difficult decision. So all of those things added together make for a very strong and compelling story. But then on top of that, I think Tennant is a fantastic performer. So much of this episode really is just shots of his face sort of looking glum as he contemplates, can I do anything? And thinking, no, I can't. But just to hold on an actor's face, I mean, he's not really doing anything. It's not as if he's pulling a face or anything. We're just looking at his face and seeing him blink and thinking, oh, look how sad he looks. Or then when he decides that he will try and do something, look how gleeful he looks. All of that is terrific because you've got a very strong performer. And then on top of it, as you say, you've got the visual effects are good, the set design is good, the music is just like the music from a movie. It's kind of a constant presence all the way through the episode. I also like the casting of this, of the other characters. You really got the sense of a multinational crew, mm-hmm. because the commander is, from all appearances, she's English. There's an Australian in there. I think there was supposed to be an American as well, at least one. So it made some efforts to look like a multinational thing. Whereas in earlier Doctor Who's, you might have had the first British colony on Mars or something. This feels like this is for everyone. It's not just for the Brits.
Yes. Are you familiar with the other works that were nominated in 2010 for the Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form?
I did look at the list, but I can't remember what else was there.
Well, there's an episode of the movie, or the television show Flash Forward, which is adapted from the book. There's an episode of Dollhouse, which is the next Joss Whedon kind of powerhouse that came out after Buffy and Angel. And then there are a total of 3 episodes of Doctor Who.
Wow. So this was a bumpy year.
Yeah. So there's The Waters of Mars, The Next Doctor, and Planet of the Dead.
Wow. I hadn't realized that because I was looking through the whole list. I did notice how often Doctor Who was being nominated and winning in that era. I made a little note. This was the 4th one to actually win a Hugo. And I think the series won 2 more Hugos after this. So, wow. You know, that entire era, that decade really, was the Doctor Who decade. And I think I said in our previous episode that there had been a bit of a slow decline in recent years. So you've got these Tennant episodes, some of which are very strong. Then you had the next Doctor, who's Matt Smith. The quality goes down a little bit. Then you get on to Peter Capaldi and Jodie Whittaker. And the actors are terrific. Mm-hmm. But the sort of the average quality of the episodes just goes down little by little, year after year, until you get to the Jodie Whittaker era, where you have yet another new showrunner. This is something else we haven't talked about, is who's in charge of this thing. But when you get to the Jodie Whittaker era, you've got Chris Chibnall is the showrunner. And frankly, although he has written some good stuff, he's not as good a writer as his predecessor, who in turn is not as good a writer as his predecessor. It's kind of built to decline as time goes on. And the interesting thing for this November with these new episodes, they are written by Russell T. Davis. Mm-hmm. And he's the guy who was the showrunner during this era, this David Tennant prime era. So they're sort of turning back the clock by bringing back Russell T. Davis to run the thing. And I think that's a good thing. I know Russell T. has some detractors, but I think he's the best thing that ever happened to Doctor Who. He's one of Britain's finest screenwriters, quite apart from his Doctor Who work. But watch this space, because I may be wrong.
Well, maybe Winnie should try and watch a little Doctor Who and see how it comes out. I mean, if my son and I are going to do like a Doctor Who retrospective, it'll take me a while to catch up. But yeah. You know, I wonder, television series are particularly unique in that most of the time, people, at least in the United States, don't think about making a single series, a single season, and telling a story and being done.
Right.
Here in the States, the idea is that you try and get your show popular enough that it runs for 5 or more seasons to create 100 episodes, because that gets you a prime deal in syndication.
Yes.
And then everything after that's kind of a bonus. And so when you look at the really popular science fiction series, like especially like Star Trek, The Clone Wars, they go 5 seasons because at 22 episodes per season, that gets you to 110. Yep. And then after that, you're in your bonus mode, right?
Yes.
And so I wonder if people have adopted mentally this idea of a 5 to 7 year lifetime. And after that, the writers are so tired of doing this that they aren't making good stuff anymore.
Yeah, could be. Where that argument would break down, though, is if you're talking about British production, we've never had those 22 episode seasons. We've always had short seasons. I mean, okay, in the early days of Doctor Who, they might have had very long seasons. But for the most part, British TV, anything that is drama or even sitcoms, you're talking about seasons of about 6 to 10 episodes. So we don't have that kind of churn or burnout or any of those things that go with being a long-running series.
Yeah. And probably not only for the writers, but also the actors.
Yes. And of course, now in the streaming age, we are seeing much shorter seasons. So streaming Star Treks are 10 episodes typically. Whereas in the old days, there were 25, 26 episodes a season. So things are changing. But I think also it might simply be that 5 years, that's quite a long time for anybody to spend in any job.
Oh, nowadays?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you think of David Tennant as a Doctor compared to William Hartnell?
You know, from an acting standpoint, I have no complaints about either one of them. So I don't feel like I can be a perfect judge of Mr. Hartnell because I did only watch two episodes and he spends half of the second episode unconscious.
Probably for the best.
Yeah, well, he does it very well.
Yes.
But yeah, David Tennant shows such a huge range of emotions. There's some of the classic Dr. Zaniness, yep. where at one point they're running away from the monsters. And he turns to the commander and says, couldn't you have put bicycles in here? Or except he just says uses bikes. Why aren't there bikes? And then just the feeling of being trapped. It's like, why can't I fix this? And then to realize, well, yes, I can. But then he assumes the cost of that decision, which is shown to him when the commander goes and takes her own life to preserve the future of the human race and its exploration of the galaxy.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
It's hard to imagine any of the previous Doctors carrying that in quite the same way. I mean, I'm sure they could all have gone through the motions, but there's something about Tennant's on-screen presence.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the media clippets, snippets and clips and photos for the next version of Good Omens that have come out.
Oh, yeah.
Where I think he plays a fallen angel and there's just so much casual arrogance in his face. And I'm thinking, this is the Doctor. So quite a good actor.
There's something that happens in this episode, though, that I think kind of lays the ground for what Doctor Who becomes after this. And that is when he decides that he is going to do something, he is going to act. He becomes quite manic, and there's a kind of a clutching at straws. There's a kind of a, what's that thing? Can I use this? Can I do that? What if I do this? And he's kind of throwing out loads of ideas. It's a bit like the way Star Trek The Next Generation used to use technobabble. That, you know, they would paint themselves into a corner from a story point of view. And then the only way out of it was to say, oh, well, if you tech the tech, then the tech will tech the tech and everything will turn out fine. And then it does. But essentially, it's waving of hands and magic happens. And I think there's a bit of that in this episode. Now, I think this episode is good and has a strong story. So it works in this context. But this kind of manic trying of everything until suddenly something happens and the problem is solved. That, it seems to me, is what future episodes of Doctor Who would come to depend on. And that's part of the deterioration of Doctor Who in the future. And it's basically where you've got writers who are kind of copying the style of this one, but without having the skill in storytelling that the writers of this one have. And the writers, we should say, for this one are Russell T. Davis and Phil Ford.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when it happens every once in a while. When it happens the same way every time, then it's not so interesting.
Yeah.
So the science fiction of this is so multi-layered, it's just amazing. So you've got the Doctor, who's a time-traveling alien who looks human.
Yeah.
And then you've got the hard science fiction of a Martian, a human base on Mars.
Yeah.
And then the level below that is, you know, these aliens trapped in the water and being transmitted through water and using water as a weapon and taking over humans. And
yeah.
So it's really nice. It's good.
It is. It's got so many things thrown in there. And you might think that that's going to make for a terrible episode because they've thrown so many ingredients in. But actually, it all blends together very well. There's moments that are like silent running. You know, when they're growing the plants and the what is it, the first carrot on Mars or whatever you said earlier. So there's a bit of that. There's a bit of sort of almost Space 1999, living in domes. And if you go outside, you have to wear a spacesuit. There's all of that going on. So it feels comfortably familiar whilst at the same time telling a new story.
It reminded me of The Martian because in the end, when they're trying to leave, they have to say, grab the protein packs, otherwise we'll starve.
Yes.
So yes, they've come and they've settled Mars and they have to leave an emergency and they have to have time to take all the food they've unloaded and put it back on the ship.
And then at the end of the episode, of course, they land in the TARDIS in a street in, I assume it's London. it sort of has that look to it. Mm-hmm. And it once again brings you back to that kind of very British look and feel to it. I don't know when this was shown. I think this was November, so I don't think it's a Christmas episode. But I kind of imagine that the snow is probably a setup for a sequel episode, which probably went out at Christmas time. They're laying the ground for the next episode. That final scene, because of the snow, looks and feels very quiet, very still, very calm. And that's where we have this sort of final dramatic confrontation between the Doctor, who's arrogantly saved the world, and the Commander, who, as you said earlier, is kind of questioning him and putting him in his place. And then she goes off, and we have the very sad ending. Beautiful manipulation of our emotions, I thought, all the way through.
You know, I know it goes towards budget, but I was struck by how much the actors carry, carry the burden of the monster transformation, where they shake and jerk and then have to turn around and, you know, then drool water out of their mouths, which comes from a prosthetic and a bunch of pumps. And despite, you know, modern Doctor Who, I don't think is aimed at children and being educational like the original series. I think it's much more dramatic.
Yeah.
It's more adult oriented. But when it came to showing something truly horrific, the Commander goes into her house and closes the door, and then there's a bright flash of light that shows through the windows. And that's how you know she's taken her life.
Yeah.
That could be done in such a way that is more graphic, more violent, more horrific. And they had it happen, but they didn't have to show all the details.
Yeah.
And I as a general criticism of current media, I think people are insisting on having to be shown all the details all the time, where we've lost the artistry and the lack of starkness in being shown everything.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I think that's part of the beauty of this episode, is that there is subtlety in there. For all the manicness that occurs when the Doctor takes his decision, and for all the craziness of the alien creatures, it has nuance. Definitely one of the best Doctor Who's I've ever seen. The funny thing is, when I was looking at the lists of Hugo nominees, the episodes that had won, I didn't remember this one. I mean, I knew the title, but I couldn't remember what the episode was about. So it was really like watching a new episode for me. I'm sure I did see it when it first went out, but I'd completely forgotten it. And going back to it now, really pleasantly surprised. It reminded me of how good Doctor Who can be.
Since you've watched more Doctor Who recently than I have, does it still ride where there are episodes that are pure fun, or are they all very serious now?
There are some fun ones. Yeah, it tends to mix things up quite a bit. And I think more often than not, he has companions, which he doesn't have in this episode. There is no companion. And that allows you to have more sort of range, more tonal range within an episode, because you can have serious bits, you can have dramatic bits, you can have humorous bits, comedy. Without a companion, there's much less for the Doctor to do in terms of bouncing off things. Here, he bounces off the Commander primarily. So, as you said earlier, she sort of is a companion for this episode and this episode only, but he arrives on Mars alone, and when he leaves Mars, he's got these people with him simply because he's rescued them. I think he needs a companion. He really does. It gives the show a lot more flavour than it would otherwise have.
Yeah.
I think once you get to the Jodie Whittaker episodes, I think they have too many companions, and they actually surrounded her version of the Doctor with a whole posse. Probably about four or five different... I might be exaggerating, but I think there are about four or five companions at the same time in some episodes. And possibly it's an attempt to make it more of an ensemble show, but if that's what they were doing, I think it's misguided, because that's not what Doctor Who is.
No.
And I think what happens in the Jodie Whittaker era is, because there are so many companions, it dilutes the power of the Doctor. And I think that's where the fundamental flaw is, and then on top of that you've got writing which isn't so good either, so the actual stories are not so good. You got any final points?
Just if you're going to watch this, I do recommend getting the DVD, because the making of documentary is phenomenal. It's informative. It follows it from the screenwriter's table all the way through final steps with special effects and production. I will say that even though the budget is higher, that they are still committed to being frugal, because at one point there's a special effect where a piece of girder drops out of the sky after an explosion. Yeah. And the special effects guy points out, you may recognize that girder from an earlier episode. And he tosses off the name. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, we're not just totally throwing money at it. We're being careful and frugal and budgeting well. I like that.
Yeah, I haven't seen those. I'll have to go and watch the behind-the-scenes stuff. I do remember during this era of Doctor Who, when it was shown on the BBC, they would typically show the episode, and then immediately afterwards they would show like a 10-minute behind-the-scenes or making-of. And I've always assumed that those are what goes onto the DVDs, so that when you see the making-of documentary, it's made up from these shorter pieces that they've already aired. But and they don't do that anymore. They don't show the behind the scenes on TV anymore. But I don't remember the behind the scenes stuff for this one, so I'll have to go and take a look at that.
Yeah, it's it was very interesting. The water effects, just to tell you a little bit about it, they couldn't pump warm water through them.
Oh no!
Because
so it's cold water.
So yeah, so these people were wearing these pipes and tubes on their body filled with cold water, and they were completely drenched in it. I don't remember when the shooting happened, but I don't think it was the height of summer. It might have been fall when it was starting to cool. So there was a real challenge in trying to keep the actors healthy while they're doing all this and as comfortable as possible.
Yeah.
So yeah, this at one point, the lady who was in isolation says, yes, you know, I'm soaked all the way down to my Doc Martens, and even my hair is wet.
Oh, that's terrible. But it is very well done, isn't it?
I mean,
the prosthetic masks in themselves, they've got a kind of a fixed, shocked look on their face. But then when the water starts coming out the mouth, you realize why that is. It's so that they can have the water flowing out freely.
Yeah.
That's very well done.
Well, and I hadn't realized. So, you know, my involvement in film is I'm mainly a consumer. I watch film. I don't make anything. I'm not a screenwriter or a filmer of you know, recorded media or anything. But at one point, as they're developing the prosthetics, they begin to do all these experiments with the actors to see what works on camera. And they finally say, yes, you want to smile, because with the prosthetic effect and the look on their face and these inhuman irises, it's super creepy.
Brilliant. Yeah. Oh, about their eyes. Did they actually, were they like contact lenses that they had in?
I believe so. Yeah.
Because that's very convincing. There was one shot, I think, where they're kind of doing a kind of a projectile vomiting of the water. Where it looked like CGI, but most of it looked genuine, you know, like real practical water running all over their bodies and coming out of their hands and everything. But there was one that looked fake to me. But even that may not have been. That might have just been the way it was shot.
I think the front-on shots where there's like huge volumes of water coming out of their mouth is either done with dummies or CGI.
Right. Shall we do a quiz?
Let's.
This will be a fairly short quiz. I've just got 5 questions for you. I'm calling this Doctor Who Goes There. And what I'm going to do, they're not really questions. They're really clues. I'm going to give you some clues to some science fictional doctors. And you've got to tell me where these doctors are from. So they're from a TV series, or they're from a book. So you've got to identify the series or the book.
Okay.
Okay. And hopefully you'll know most of these, so it'll be a very easy quiz. And I'm not going to bother keeping score.
Oh.
Because I can't figure out the scoring system for this, quite honestly. Anyway, here's the first one. I'll give you the name first of all. Dr. Rudy Wells. Does that name mean anything to you?
Dr. Rudy Wells is the doctor who cared for Steve Austin in the television show The $6 Million Man.
Correct. Yes, indeed. I've got sort of follow-on clues for you. So if you hadn't got it from the name, I would have told you that he was an expert in cybernetic organisms, that he's able to work within a fixed budget, typically $6 million, and he can restore legs, arms, eyes, and ears. And he works for Oscar Goldman, was going to be my last hint.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got that from the very first bit from the name of the character, which is great. Let's see if you can do that for the second one. The doctor is Dr. Philip Boyce.
Dr. Philip Boyce.
Yep. Give you more information.
Please.
He's a chief medical officer.
Chief medical officer. That sounds like something from the Star Trek universe.
Could be. He also functions as something of a barman, when appropriate.
Barman? Chief medical officer. Boyce.
He mixes drinks. He was preceded, probably, by one Dr. Mbenga. He was followed by one Dr. Mark Piper.
And this would be Star Trek New Horizons?
No.
Okay.
And he was followed by one Leonard McCoy.
So that's definitely Star Trek. I don't know the series, though.
Ah, okay. It is the original series, but it's actually the first pilot of Star Trek, The Cage. That was the ship's doctor, was Dr. Boyce.
Okay.
Played by John Hoyt. The next one, you may get this from the name, Dr. Calvin.
Dr. Susan Calvin would be in either the iRobot movie or the original novels.
Correct. Yes. Do you know what her job title would be?
It's something like chief cyberneticist, but it's actually for humaniform no, it's not humaniform. It's for all robots. No, wait a minute. Is she a psychomathematician? No.
You got a couple of syllables correct there. I think, to be honest, I can't remember where I got this word from, but I've written down that she's a robo-psychologist. So I think I've got that from the book, from iRobot, but I can't honestly remember where I got the word from. But yeah, you got Dr. Calvin straight away. I deliberately left out the Susan because I thought that might be too big of a clue.
Yeah.
Now the next one, I'm just going to say Griffin.
Griffin.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, this one, he probably didn't actually become a doctor, but we know that he did attend medical school, and he left early. I don't mean like he went home at 3 o'clock. I mean he left without completing his studies. He was in the same class as Dr. Kemp.
Yes, yes. And the poor man just had a problem with being transparent because he's from the Invisible Man.
That's right. Yes. 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 He had trouble being seen.
Yes. Well, yeah, with somebody stealing his work all the time, and that's just what happens.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's fully justified in what he did, I thought. My final clue was going to be, you may get an appointment with Griffin, but you will rarely get to see him.
Oh, that's horrible. That is one of the best dad jokes I've heard all week. My first thought was that he was the character from the movie Jumper.
Oh.
Yeah, Davy meets a more experienced teleporter named Griffin. And then later on, he gets his own pre-development story as a novel written by the same author. That's okay. Let's move on.
The final one, very simple name, really. Dr. Smith.
That is from Lost in Space.
Correct. Yes. And do you know what type of doctor he was?
Based on his enunciation, I'd say he was a doctor of Shakespearean literature, but I don't think he was a medical doctor or anything else.
Well, according to Wikipedia, he was a psychologist and an environmental expert. So there you go. And that's it. So of the five, you got four of them with very few clues. You needed quite a bit of prompting for Griffin, but yeah, pretty good.
Thank you.
So that was Doctor Who Goes There. Shall we do a past, present, and future?
Yes. I have a tangentially past item, and I'll talk about more of it in the future, but I started reading Dracula.
Oh, yeah.
And it strikes me, you know, culturally, how much and little people know about science fiction and horror like that. Because most people, I don't think, know that Dracula is dead. So Dracula starts off in Transylvania, and then he does something else that most people don't know. He moves to Britain, Great Britain.
Yeah.
And that's where he's hunted down and killed by people that don't want him killing people over there. Mm-hmm. So this idea that Dracula lives on, or Dracula does this, or Dracula is only in Transylvania, reminds me of Frankenstein, where everyone thinks that Frankenstein is the name of the monster versus the doctor.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've just been struck at source materials and current understandings and beliefs about stuff.
Mm. What do you think of it as a book?
In general, I'm not a fan of the extremely older science fiction, like from the 1800s. I find it hard to read, and I was, as we start to shift this to a talk about the present, I was reading Dracula to try and find the one chapter that is the basis for the recently released movie The Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you that don't want to do a slog, it's in the middle of chapter 7, and it's it's 5 pages. That's what you're looking for.
Oh, wow.
Just 5 pages. There's a little bit that comes before that sets the stage, and there's a little bit that comes after, which kind of closes out that episode. But to get there, you have to sit through 2 chapters of romance information about a lady and her multiple suitors, who all do become characters in the book later. But I couldn't find any interest in this lady's social calendar and the people she turns down for being her fiance and other stuff.
Yeah, my memory of it is that it's not a great book. It's funny because in the popular consciousness, Dracula and Frankenstein are thought of as being somehow comparable, you know. But whereas Frankenstein is a very powerful book, I don't think Dracula is. I think it's a bit dull in places. And of course, if I remember correctly, it's largely an epistolary novel, isn't it? It's largely written as a collection of letters, correspondence between different people.
Yeah, in a movie you would call that found footage.
Yes, yes. Anyway, that's fantasy, not science fiction. What are we doing?
I do have another present item, and it's also kind of in the vein of self-promotion. Mm-hmm. On my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader, that I do with Seth and James, we recently had on Braggy F. Shute, who was the writer for The Last Voyage of the Demeter. And he came on to our show to talk about the 25-year history of getting his script produced.
Good grief.
So yeah, as a young professional, he worked in a model shop in Hollywood, and he got to see the scale model of the Demeter from Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh, yes.
And that gave him this idea about writing, it gave him an idea of how to get over a problem he had with a script idea he'd been developing. And he wrote this script, and it has gone through revision and rewrites and hands to hands, and has finally been produced.
And as I think you will have seen on Facebook, where I posted a comment, that film isn't going to be distributed in the UK at present because there is some hitch with the distribution company. I think the company went bust or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully it'll come online in time for a good October Halloween scare watch.
That'd be good. Yeah. I've got a present item here, which is Doctor Who related. Very related, in fact, highly relevant to our podcast. Mm-hmm. The episode The Waters of Mars, the Hugo Award-winning episode from the David Tennant era?
Yeah.
There's a novelization has just appeared by Phil Ford, who is one of the co-writers of the script for that episode. And so, yeah, it's been published in the Doctor Who series from Target Books. And that came out in July of 2023. I don't know why it took so long for anyone to write a novelization of it, but it's always good when one of the original script writers does the adaptation, because you know that there's some commitment there to the quality of the story. So I don't know that I've ever read a Doctor Who novel. If I have, it was decades ago. But I might give this one a try.
Yeah, a reverse adaptation like that, a novelization, sometimes can reveal a lot of interesting things. You know, ideas that weren't able to be filmed, clarifications and thoughts and character motivations.
Yeah.
Move on to the future.
The Australian company Via Vision Entertainment is putting out an HD version of the 1980 miniseries The Martian Chronicles, which is not a great series, and it has been out on Blu-ray before, but this is the first version that has any significant extras on the discs.
Oh.
So there's a commentary by Gary Gerani, who's quite a well-respected media journalist, and there's interviews with a few visual effects people. I'm not sure whether they're people who worked on the series or whether they're just sort of there as experts. And they're also, onto the discs, they're putting the American Icon documentary on Ray Bradbury, which has been released before, but it's never been released as part of this sort of package. So that's coming out in September. And then the other one I've got is the film It Came From Outer Space, which is 70 years old this year.
Wow.
Everything in science fiction is really old now, have you noticed?
Including us.
I don't know. It probably wasn't the first 3D science fiction film, but it's one of the better three-dimensional films that were made in that 1950s era. And it's coming out on 4K Blu-ray. And the main release is not the 3D version, but apparently the 3D version is going to be on there on the disc. So anyone with a 3D TV, which I don't have, and they don't make 3D TVs anymore, so I don't know who's going to be able to appreciate it. But anyway, it's coming out in HD and 3D with some extras as well, and that's coming out in October from Universal.
Cool.
Any more future items from you?
No. No.
I think we're done, don't you?
Yes. It was a good episode of Doctor Who and for what we've done.
Yeah, well, I hope so. So, thanks for listening, folks. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Cuskey. Our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com. Check out our show notes at 101sf.blogspot.com, where you can also leave us a comment or drop us a couple of bucks in the tip jar. And don't forget to give us a nice 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.